This election season, we've invited all of the Republican and Democratic candidates vying to represent Iowa's four new congressional districts to share their views. Today, Christy Vilsack and Leonard Boswell. This is River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. In the first half hour, Iowa's former First Lady, Christy Vilsack. She's challenging Republican Congressman Steve King in Iowa's new 4th District. Then in the second half hour, we shift south to the congressional race in Iowa's new 3rd District. We'll talk with incumbent Democrat Leonard Boswell, who is facing another incumbent, Republican Tom Latham. That's all coming up after a look at this hour's news. This is River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer, and my next guest is Iowa's former First Lady, Christy Vilsack. She is the Democratic challenger to Republican Congressman Steve King, and they are competing to represent Iowa's new 4th congressional district. It's 39 counties in north central and the northwestern part of the state, including the cities of Sioux City, Fort Dodge, Carroll, among many others. And we want to note that we extended an invitation to all of Iowa's congressional candidates, and we want to thank Christy Vilsack for accepting our invitation. Christy Vilsack, welcome to River to River.
Thank you so much, Ben. I'm happy to be here.
Christy Vilsack, you've been casting this as a race between you, who say you want to represent the local interests of this new district, and the incumbent congressman, who you say cares more about standing on principle than standing up for his constituents. I wonder if you can start off by giving us an example of an instance when your opponent took a position that went against the interests of this district.
Well, I think there are quite a few, but one of the ones I think that is most illustrative is the fact that he basically told the people in the old 5th district, the district he now represents, which is the western third of the state, that he would make sure that he put an earmark, put appropriations into bills for Highway 20 and also for Interstate 29. It was millions of dollars, and he did put the appropriations in the bill, but within 2 hours to a day, he voted against those bills. So he really voted against the best interests of the people in his district. And then when other people's representatives from other states and other places voted for, and also in the Iowa delegation voted for those bills, and they were passed, he put out press releases to the people in his district suggesting he'd had something to do with that, and then came home and had his picture taken on the stage and leaned over to legislators and other officials on the stage to tell them that he didn't vote for the bill, but he didn't tell the people of his district that. So he now is going out and acting as if Highway 20 is something that he contributed to when he actually voted against it and voted against Interstate 29 improvements and also voted against numerous bills that were for flood prevention. So when the Missouri River flooded and he has gone up and down the river talking about how he wants to take care of people who were hurt by the flooding, I think that it's disingenuous when he voted against a number of bills that really would have prevented the flood.
Christy Vilsack, I wonder then if you can give us an example of a local issue to the new 4th District of Iowa, issue or an interest you believe you would better represent in Congress.
Sure. Well, I'm really running for Congress for one very focused reason, and that's because I've always been an advocate for small towns and small cities. I spent most of my time as First Lady in the 8 years that I was representing everybody in the state, traveling around to the small places of Iowa and talking about education issues and issues of public libraries and also economic development issues. So I'm really focused on making sure that we rebuild the middle class in the small towns and small cities of the district. And I have put out a plan to do that, and it's a layered plan. I really think that if we want to attract another generation of young people to small town Iowa, that we need to have a lot of different opportunities for them, not just one company on the edge of town that employs 400 people, but lots of varieties. And I carry a soy football around with me. I've got it here with me now. And the soy, I just am making the case to people that we can create a whole layer of economic opportunity that is bio-based. And we have already started that. We have a great place to begin because in this district, we produce more ethanol, we produce more wind, we produce more biofuels. And from those, we already have distiller's grain that becomes feed for cattle. But there are so many other products, some of them we can't even imagine. But let me give you some examples. And these could be products that we make in small manufacturing entities in these small towns that employ 15, 30, 60 people. And we would have a lot of those going on. So the soy football that I carry is really the substance that almost every car and truck that we see out on the road now when it leaves the line in Detroit, the interior seats are made from the soybean foam. So there's a product that we could be creating in small town Iowa. Mm-hmm. Coca-Cola, for instance, no longer makes their bottles from any kind of petroleum-based product. They're all bio-based. And we could be making the what is formerly known as plastic bottles, but bio-based bottles in these small communities. We know that the best adherent now for asphalt is hog manure. And we know that the substance that's inside of dandelions that stained our clothes when we were kids is going to be a substitute for rubber. So there are any number of things that we could be making in these small towns. And I want to extend the definition of what it is to be a congressperson beyond the really important issues of balancing the budget and the important issues of helping individual constituents to really being a spokesperson for the communities that I want to serve and the counties that I want to serve and the economic regions and really going out and helping figure out what products we could be making in these small towns and to help create those small businesses. And I've had a great conversation with President Leith at Iowa State University, and I've heard him speak independently of this. And he really wants to be a partner. He thinks the university should be a partner in these communities. Many of the students who come to Iowa State come from my district and come to Iowa State, and we want them to stay, and we need to create a pathway for them to stay in Iowa. And I think we can make the case to them that we're creating the most exciting jobs in the country right here in Iowa, and they're energy-based. Mm-hmm. I had a conversation with Wesley Clark, General Clark, who's now very involved in renewable fuels, and he said that the future Bill Gateses in this country are not going to be in Silicon Valley. They're going to be connected with energy because energy is the job of the future and the issue of the future. And so I think we need to – we've already got a firm base to build on, and I think we need to start imagining what we could possibly do in these small towns and small cities to create that opportunity and then make sure that every small town and small city is connected with high-speed internet. Mm-hmm. So that young people can live in small places, have that sense of community that's so important, but have it in a 21st century way so that they could have a job that might be based in Chicago, but they could be in Hampton, for instance. Uh-huh. And they could be entrepreneurial. And I've got lots of examples of things that are really already happening. And one of them is in Jefferson on the square. There's a business called All Ability Bicycles. And they sell bikes like many bike shops do, but they also custom make bicycles for people with disabilities. Children with spina bifida or veterans who've lost a limb. And, you know, there aren't enough people who are disabled in Jefferson and in Greene County to make that business go. But because they're connected with high-speed internet, they can sell that product all over the country, all over the world. And I think that we can create that base, but we have to be able to imagine. We have to invest in research and development, continue to support places like Iowa State. But the sky's the limit. And I think that as a congressperson, that I can really help connect the people in my district to these opportunities. And I think anytime anybody is representing any district, but certainly this one, that when you have a chance to be on national television or you have a chance to be on the radio or you're traveling in the Far East in China or Japan or Korea, or you have an opportunity to have lunch with anybody, any place in this country, that it should always be an opportunity to bring something home, a deliverable home to the district. And so that's how I see the job very locally. And I just think my opponent sees it really more through a Washington lens and has said that he sees the job as he sees his job as moving the country to the right.
What evidence do you have that you say you would like to rebuild the 4th District, mm-hmm. and many of those counties are in the old 5th District that Congressman King presently represents? What evidence do you have that the middle class in that district, that those counties that are in his district now, have suffered during his time as congressman? In what way has that damage come as a result of his positions or actions in Congress?
Well, I think it's more about his inattention. I don't think he said that if all he had to do was take care of the needs of the people of the 4th District that he'd have time to go fishing. And I just want, I see it differently. I see that it's a 24/7 job and that it really is as much about the people in the district as it is about national issues. And of course, a balanced budget's going to affect the district and the Affordable Care Act is going to affect the district. But I also think that we have fewer farmers now. They're much more efficient, so we don't need as many of them. When I was growing up in rural Iowa, my dad always said, if the farmers are doing well, everyone's doing well. And that's still true to an extent. But when you need fewer farmers, then main streets and small towns have a harder time of making a go of it. And we didn't really make that transition, and we lost a lot of young people. And so now I think that we've lost a lot of the middle class in some of these small towns. And it's the evidence of that is that we've lost a congressperson. We've gone from 5 to 4 because we've lost population. But I think that there's this resilience. And in a place like Pocahontas County, which lost more population than just about any other county, at a time, at a huge downturn in our economy, they basically voted by 70%. They voted for a school bond issue, which I thought was really tremendous, really faced with kind of their own demise. They looked it in the eye and said, you know, we're not down and out. And they created this amazing school that is high tech, and they've trained teachers, and from the superintendent on down, these folks have created what I think is a model school in a small rural area. And I think it bodes well for the future. But as I've laid out my policy initiatives, and I've laid them out in what I refer to metaphorically as a 7-layer salad so people can remember them, I've tried to create in each one of them a rural component, because this is a rural district and I very much want to represent this district of small towns. So if it's an education policy, then I have suggested that we should be creating rural learning centers around the country so that we can actually train teachers who want to go to rural schools, not as a stepping stone to a larger place, a place that pays more money, but they really want to go there because they want to live there for the rest of their lives. But how are the issues in a small town school different from those in a more urban area? And how do you retain teachers in a place where one teacher might have to teach advanced math, science classes, 5 of them in a row with no one down the hall to go ask a question of? And Pocahontas and other schools, I'm just using them as an example. There are others that are doing this as well, but they're dealing with these issues and trying to find ways to make living in a small town and teaching in a small town a great experience, and learning in a small town a great experience.
If you've just joined us, my guest this half hour is Kristi Vilsack, a Democratic challenger to Republican Congressman Steve King, competing to represent Iowa's new 4th Congressional District. Now, if my information is correct, Kristi, 3 polls, the most recent ones date back to September 27th, so show Representative King with a single-digit lead in most of these polls, somewhere around that.
Right.
You're behind, pretty much tied.
Mm-hmm. Statistical.
You've been highly critical of some of the more conservative positions that Congressman King has taken over the years, immigration, same-sex marriage, to name a couple of those. But this is a congressman who has been overwhelmingly elected by voters in his district for the past 10 years. What do you think that says about the voters in this district?
I think it says that for 10 years they didn't have an exercise in democracy, because they never got to know the other candidate. There were 5 candidates, and Congressman King would never debate any of them, and none of them were well funded enough that they could get his attention or even put one ad on television. And so, as much as I would like to reform the system, when I get to Congress, it will be a priority of mine to reform the system so that we don't have all of these independent expenditures and so much money. The only thing that got Congressman King's attention was money. And he wouldn't have paid any attention to me either if I hadn't raised $1 million in 2011.
In fact, you've raised more than, almost $3 million. You're
yes.
One of the best fundraisers nationwide among candidates for the House, aren't you?
I am. And, you know, I wanted to get his attention. And he said early in this race that I'd never done anything and I shouldn't even be running for Congress because I'd never done anything. And I think that's a slight to every teacher in the state. I've been a teacher for 38 years. I've started two nonprofits. And I served as First Lady for 8 years when I represented everybody in this district, whether they were Democrats, Republicans, or independents. And when I go to Congress, I'm going to represent everybody, just as I did as First Lady, whether they voted for me or not. So I think that what's happening now, and we just did our sixth debate last night, is that people are actually having a chance, and people are coming out to these debates because they haven't had a chance to see two candidates sitting or standing next to one another and talking about issues and talking about the differences between them. So I don't think that that Congressman King, it's not as if he's been elected because he's done anything great. He's simply been elected because nobody knew what the other person stood for, because they never had the opportunity to have a forum. And so that's what's happening this time. And people are actually getting a chance to look us over and listen to what we have to say. And I wish we could do that without the independent expenditures, but I can't govern until I get elected.
Right.
So.
A lot of money. We have national groups plowing a lot of cash into this battle between you and Congressman King, more than half a dozen organizations from both parties. Combined spending of something like $3 million thrown into it. This worries a lot of voters on both sides of the aisle. Can make one feel, it's not easy, not hard to see how it makes a person feel a little disenfranchised when it seems to be all about big money. What would be your idea for campaign finance reform, and would you fight for that in Congress?
Well, there was a Disclose Act that was put before Congress that didn't go anywhere. And I'm not sure that that's the answer necessarily, but it was a start and nothing happened. So there are a lot of things I think we can do, but it requires people getting into a room who want to negotiate and want to compromise. And again, I think at this time in history, we don't need somebody who is so resolute that he digs his heels in and never apologize for anything he's ever done and won't budge on an issue. I think that what Congress needs now, not only from our district, but from districts across the country, is people who bring a different lens and people who are willing to collaborate and people who are willing to compromise. And I think that's why I bring my teacher lens, I bring my small town lens, I would bring for the first time a female lens, and also the lens of being 62 years old and being a pretty independent thinker. I'm not running for anything else. I'm not... I'm not at a place in my life where I'm going to move up. I'm running for a very particular reason. I have a very particular goal to make sure that we recreate opportunity in these small towns. And so I'm not going to be easily influenced by anybody, for that matter. And so, you know, I think there are so many big issues as well. And I just worry that if we keep sending resolute people back to Congress, that the definition of insanity is doing the same thing over and over and over again and expecting a different result. So if we want to move forward, right now we have no education bill, we have no transportation bill, we have no infrastructure bill, we have no jobs bill, we have no immigration reform bill, and most important for people in the Midwest and people in rural areas, we have no farm bill. And so people are really paralyzed. People aren't investing, they feel insecure. And we need to move forward because our competitors out there, our economic competitors, are certainly moving forward and investing in infrastructure. And we need to be doing that, too. And I just worry that if we keep sending the same people back, that they're just going to sit there and not get anything done. And this Congress has been the most ineffective Congress in my lifetime, maybe in the history of Congress. And I'm not sure. I think Congressman King is considered by many to be one of the most ineffective members of our delegation because he doesn't stand with the rest of the delegation. Even on something as seemingly elementary as the Farm Bill, he set himself aside and refused to sign the petition that Congressman Braley put out there to force it to a vote.
Mm-hmm. You haven't appeared with President Obama, despite the fact that he's campaigned in the new 4th District, despite the fact that he's visited the 4th at least, I think, twice this fall. You are undoubtedly an Obama backer, but
yes.
Why haven't you stood beside him at a rally?
Well, because my schedule doesn't jive with his. If I sat around waiting to find out when the president was coming to Iowa, I would be sitting in Ames and not being able to go anyplace. So my schedule...
Really, it's a scheduling problem.
It is a scheduling problem. And when I haven't been able to be there, I've sent my husband, who's my very best surrogate and a good friend of the president's. But Certainly the president doesn't need me to make his case to Iowans, and I think it's great any time a presidential candidate, no matter who it is, comes, or the president comes to Iowa. Bill Clinton, President Clinton's schedule is a little more flexible than President Obama's. And
you have appeared with him, yes.
He came out last week to be with me in Sioux City and help me make an ad. So I feel really good about that.
You mentioned being a female candidate as important. If elected, you'd be the first woman, as you mentioned, from Iowa to be elected to either Congress or to the governorship. I think we are one of two states, isn't it, that have not elected a female representative or governor, representative to Congress in Washington or governor. Why is that important? How much of an influence do you think that might have on the outcome of this race?
I don't know that it will have an impact on the outcome of the race per se. I just think it's important that we have that lens. I think there are a lot of lenses in Congress, and I use as an example sometimes because people say sometimes, well, how can you make a difference, one person? And I say, well, look, I've told you what my lenses are, but there's Val Deming, who is an African-American woman younger than I, from Orlando, Florida, and she was the police chief in Orlando, one of the major cities in Florida, and she's running for Congress. And then there's Tammy Duckworth next door in Illinois, who was a veteran and lost both of her legs in a helicopter accident. Again, a little bit younger than I, from a completely different background than Val and than I. But if you put the three of us in Congress, we're going to change something. And it's not just about being women. It will be partly that, but it would be for a lot of other reasons, the backgrounds and the lenses that we bring to the conversation. But, you know, I think as a woman and as an older woman, maybe a wise woman, I think that I bring a lot to the conversation. But I also say that as a teacher, that when I look at these 39 counties, that I'll see them much as I will have seen my students on the first day of school, with all the promise that involves. And when I look at the 39 counties, I see my job in Congress as to get to know all of them as well as possible and get to know their needs. And I've already started that process over the last year and a half, identify those needs, and then figure out how I can help them maximize their potential.
Kristi Vilsack, I want to thank you for this conversation and end by asking you about this because, of course, your husband, Secretary of Agriculture, Tom Vilsack, former governor of Iowa, for 8 years. You've had many years of experience on the campaign trail as a spouse of a candidate. Now you've had several months, intense months, as a candidate yourself. Is it what you expected?
It is. It absolutely is. It's a little easier to be the candidate than it is to be the spouse of the candidate, as my husband is finding out.
Why would that be?
Because you have more control.
Okay.
And Tom, as I just talked to him a few minutes ago, he's on his way back to be the spouse now for the next few days, and I'm looking forward to having him. I appreciate not only the fact that he's going to stand beside me, but he has for years, as I have with him. And we met over politics. We've been doing it together for a long time, and now he's finding out what this is about and knows that it's not that easy. He gets really nervous before debates, and I know he wishes he could do something to make it easier for me, but he's been a great mentor and obviously a great friend, and he's got lots of good advice, and the best advice he's ever given me is politics is a series of temporary alliances, so you never want to burn bridges, because the person that may be on the other side today may be on your side next week, and I think that's pretty good advice.
Kristi Vilsack, thank you very much for this conversation.
Thank
you. We appreciate it. Coming up after a short break, we shift south to the congressional race in Iowa's new 3rd District, which includes central and southwest counties of the state. We'll talk with incumbent Democrat Leonard Boswell. He's facing another incumbent, Republican Tom Latham. Your questions for Leonard Boswell, 1-866-780-9100. Back in just a few minutes with more of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. Back with more of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. This election season, we've invited all of the Republican and Democratic candidates vying to represent Iowa's 4 new congressional districts to share their views. Tomorrow on this program, 2nd District Congressman Dave Loebsack will be here on this program. Also his challenger, GOP challenger John Archer. Today, this half hour, my guest is 8-term Democratic incumbent Congressman Leonard Boswell of Iowa's 3rd District. Now, remember, due to redistricting, because Iowa lost one seat in the House, down from 5 seats to 4, beginning in 2012, Boswell Congressman Boswell is facing another incumbent, nine-term Republican Tom Latham from Iowa's old 4th District. And the new 3rd District is comprised of 16 counties, covers many central Iowa counties, including Polk and Dallas counties, as well as the southwest corner of the state. The race between Boswell and Latham is still considered a toss-up. We want to welcome Congressman Leonard Boswell to our studio in Des Moines. Welcome to you, Congressman.
Well, thank you, Ben. It's good to be with you today, and I appreciate the service that public radio gives to all of us. I'm so glad that you're there to give the what I refer to as the unbiased report.
Okay, thank you. We'll hope that that service improves a little bit with the sound quality in the next couple of seconds. We want to reach out to our listeners and ask you for your questions for Congressman Boswell this week, this hour, this half hour. 1-866-780-9100, 1-866-780-9100. River to River at iowapublicradio.org is our email. We're also on Facebook, or you can tweet us at IPR Talk. Both of you, Congressman Boswell, are incumbents with long records. I think together the two of you have over 30 years of experience on Capitol Hill. But I wonder, if you were to narrow the key differences between the two of you down to a couple of issues that are your highest priority, what would you be? What do you want to tell constituents in the new 3rd District is most important for you? What issues and what positions are different?
Okay, well, back to your question, very concerned about the economy and good-paying jobs for American workers and making things here with American hands in the United States. Over the last few years, we've seen a lot of jobs leave Iowa, leave the country, and of course one that will always burn in my mind is our homegrown Maytag over in Newton. And as I went through all that, and we don't have time to go into all the details, but in my opinion, that did not have to happen, but it did. Mm-hmm. So very concerned about those kind of things as the economy, and also for us to get into alternative fuels and not have so much need to be in bondage to OPEC and to go after the alternatives, which I've been doing for a number of years. When I first realized I was still in uniform in a NATO assignment and could see what happens to a community just like ours, mm-hmm. wherever you might be, if you don't have fuel for your truck or your car and so on. But, you know, a willingness to compromise, I think, is probably the big difference you would probably refer to. I know we have to make cuts and look after the deficit, even though there's a little amnesia how we got there. We have to deal with it. It's the how we deal, and so I would guess we'll talk about that some in the next few minutes.
Mm-hmm. But, on the jobs question, how do you differ? How are you different than Congressman Latham in your approach? He likes to bring out the stimulus package, many hundreds of billions of dollars, and to bring that out against you.
Well, he sure does. And if we had not have done the stimulus, and we would have seen the layoffs of police force, teachers, firemen, emergency medical people, and we could see what the impact would have been on top of the recession we were already in, I would guess it would have probably put us over the cliff. And I was concerned about that. I grew up in an era where my father and my grandfather talked to me frequently as a youngster about the awful impact and the struggle of the Great Depression. And when Secretary Paulson under President Bush came to us in September of 08, said that we were on the brink of that, why it started a process that we had to think about very carefully, and perhaps we could have done things better, but I still think we did what we needed to do at that time to keep us from going into depression. As they described it, would have been much worse than the Great Depression.
You have no doubt that this would have been greater than the Great Depression of the 30s had that stimulus package not
been
offered.
Well, that's what we were told by lots of economists, and in fact, Secretary of the Treasury Paulson under President Bush at that time in a very strong voice and gave us a lot of data, indicated that would happen if we didn't react immediately on the TARP program. And then, of course, at that time, that was in September. November, we had an election. The president was president-elect. In the following January, he did get inaugurated, and we were losing like 800,000 jobs a month. and that has been stopped. The stimulus was part of slowing that down, and it would be hard to imagine what would have happened to our country and maybe the whole world economy if we had not have done that. Mm-hmm.
You mentioned alternative fuels, energy independence as one of the key differences that you would like constituents to know about. Both of you, however, are in favor of renewing the wind energy tax credit. So where do your differences
lie? Well, I am, and you've heard some of our debates, I'm sure, Ben, and you know, when you're trying to go out and, as we say, down on the farm, plow new ground and find out ways to achieve things, everything doesn't always work out perfectly. But I think we have to look at all alternatives, including solar and electric cars. So you've heard a lot about, but you know, that's going to happen in some places. In fact, I have been given some thought about buying an electric-powered light airplane, and it's coming, and everything you try with the best science you've got at that moment doesn't necessarily always work, but you don't just say, well, not going to do that no more. You know, you're going to try to do it the next time, do it better, and collect more information. But I think we have to look at all our alternatives and be willing to do that, but at the same time, keeping in mind the next generation and what's the impact going to be on next generations, and make sure we're not leaving them with environmental problems that they can't deal with. We don't have a right to do that, so we've got to proceed with some caution.
So what is your prescription? How would you go forward? Were you to be reelected? What would your position on cutting the deficit?
Well, I was one of the 38 that voted for a version of the Simpson-Bowles study that would address debt and cuts and efficiencies and redundancies. At the same time, it would leave the door open and to look at possibility of revenue. There's been different suggestions. For every $4 you cut, you raise $2, or every $2 you cut, you raise $1. But anyway, we had an opportunity, and it was very bipartisan. If you go back and reflect on those 38 of us that voted for that, Republican and Democrat, and it would be a departure point. I don't for a minute suggested that would be the final product, because you go through the whole process of committee work, floor work in both the House and the Senate, but we need to be coming together and working on something, and that's the only thing that's been put on the table in the last 2 years that would give us probably a chance to do that.
In the area of energy policy, you support a federal gas tax increase. Representative Latham disagrees. Latham says it penalizes us here, especially in a rural state where a lot of people have to drive 10 or 20 miles to work. We don't have subways as they might have in New York.
Well, yes, we've been discussing this now for several years, and the price of steel, the price of concrete, and the condition of our roads, just on out there today in some roads that are so full of potholes and problems in some of the country roads. And as our farms have gotten bigger, and they have, and the need to transport the farm products, whether it's livestock or grain or what, there's a lot of need to be able to put it down the road. And, you know, the farm groups are even saying, well, we're going to have to put some more revenue into this. And so the use side is the way to do it. And so it's not just my idea. It's, you know, it's Farm Bureau and the commodity groups. And the thing
But at a time when why not wait a little bit until we know the economy is chugging along better? It's still struggling, right?
Well, it's still struggling, but it is better. And when it comes to infrastructure, Ben, it's not going to get better. It's going to get worse. And if we just keep putting it off, it's going to cost a whole lot more. And there's some things you can't put off. Bridges start falling in. People get hurt. Equipment gets broken. Steering mechanisms, axles, and tires. And it just goes on and on. And I think the people that are actually using and depending on our infrastructure realize we have to do something, and we're already behind as far as competing with internationally and so on. You go to China, Japan, Europe, and you don't see roads like what we've let ours get into. We get out to these, and that includes those country roads. And yes, nobody wants to do that, but we have to have dependable road services and bridges and be able to move our products and our people.
If you've just joined us, my guest this half hour is Congressman Leonard Boswell of Iowa's 3rd District. He is up against Republican Tom Latham for vying for to represent Iowa's new 3rd District. If you have a question, 1-866-780-9100. Mm-hmm. Question for Leonard Boswell, 1-866-780-9100, rivertoriver@iowapublicradio.org, our email. Congressman Boswell, your opponent, Tom Latham, has accused your campaign of, quote, intentionally scaring, confusing, and tricking Iowa seniors by lying about what Congressman Latham calls his principled record on important retirement security issues. We're talking about Social Security and Medicare, of course. Respond to that.
Well, there is a record where he has indicated that he would privatize Social Security. So if you want to us provide that to you.
He says in his campaign now he would never vote to privatize
Well,
security.
I'm glad he said that, but at one time he said that he would, and that's what that's about. And as far as the business that he talks about, in according to Medicare, there's just no truth to it. There's no senior citizen out there that is in jeopardy of losing their Medicare as we know it now. But if we go to that Ryan plan that he supports and I do not, there will be lots of problems, a lot of expenses to seniors that they have not planned on or prepared for. And we don't need to do that. There's other ways to go about it, and we've already touched on one, but we can probably talk about more. But
Would be your way forward for Social Security and Medicare to keep them solvent?
Social Security is really not part of the problem. The ones that's trying to scare people is actually him. It's not part of the problem. The Social Security is still solvent, and a simple way, if we need to raise it, is to raise the caps, either some or all, and that would do it. I don't know what you get paid, Ben, and I'm not asking, but let's say the average worker out there, let's just put a figure on it. I don't know if it'll be accurate, but say they're making $60,000, $70,000 a year. They pay on everything that they earn, everything. And maybe the guy across town is making, up around 200.
Well, yeah, he only pays payroll taxes, correct?
But he only pays on his social, up to 110, and it stops.
Mm-hmm.
And if one on one hand has to pay on everything he earns, and is a good citizen, and supports the community, and providing good services, and all the things that. So many of our middle-class working families do, then why would they be treated different than somebody that has done better and maybe a little more fortunate or whatever they got into or maybe had a better chance at education? Who knows? But the Social Security is not the problem. That was easy solving of that.
What about Medicare?
Well, Medicare, if we go to what Congressman Latham proposes and go to the turnover of the Affordable Care Act— then Medicare goes out in 2016. And with what we did there and the savings for some of the providers, basically the insurance companies making big profits in this case, and they must be still doing all right. They were up like in the 14% on it. Well, they're still in the high percentage because there's still mail going out asking you to come and sign up with them. So they're doing okay. And that gives us 8 or 10 years to be able to work on this after we get past this event that's going on between now and November the 6th. Mm-hmm. We'll have time to do it. But if it gets turned over to 2016, it's defunct. We don't need to go there. That's not necessary, and that is not a good plan.
In the 5 or so minutes we have left, I'd like to turn to outside of the borders of the United States. You mentioned your military background. You work with NATO. You were, just to recap, to remind our listeners, you were drafted into the U.S. Army in 1956, I believe. You chose to stay for 2 decades, rising to lieutenant colonel before retiring in 1976. You served as a helicopter pilot in Vietnam, awarded 2 Distinguished Flying Crosses, 2 Bronze Stars, and a Soldier's Medal. Let me ask you about Afghanistan. What do you think should be the size and nature of the residual force left in Afghanistan?
Well, I'm willing, and I've been on record for this, Ben. The last time I was over there, General Caldwell, who was commandant at the Command General Staff College before he went to that assignment, and that assignment he was in charge of all the NATO efforts, training their police and their army, and they did a really a good job. I looked that over very carefully. I spent some time with General Caldwell, and I know him well and appreciate his expertise. It was very good. Had a great team. And so we can leave somebody for some time to make to help their training and use of equipment and so on, but it's time to bring our forces home. And I told President Karzai that when I was there that trip. I had the opportunity to sit with him and in a very respectful way, and he made it clear that he wanted us to stay for a lengthy time and maintain bases and lots of troops and so on. And I just told him, I said, you know, Mr. President, you've come to a fork in the road. You know what to do. You know how to do it. We put a lot of expense in here and a lot of lives. Now the people at home think we've done what we can do, and it's time to bring our troops home. And I'm going to support that. I will continue to support the project of the countries under NATO, and this time, as I've just mentioned, General Caldwell, to go ahead and help train your police and help train your armed forces to where you can make the choice, this fork in the road, and go the direction that you're able to go now and not go back to the tribal situation that you've been in for centuries. But you have to make the choice. We cannot make it for you. This is something that you'll have to do, and we wish you well.
Let's turn to Iran. How much more progress by Iran toward a nuclear weapon can the U.S. tolerate? Where do you see that red line, Congressman Boswell, that the U.S. should not let Iran cross?
Well, with what they've said about destroying Israel and us too, the rhetoric, which and there's some things I cannot share with you from the terms that I spent on the Intelligence Committee not too long ago and my background in the military itself. We can't. I don't see how we can let them have a nuclear weapon.
You can't imagine a scenario of containment like we did with the old USSR.
Well, here's what I think that is. I think in a sense that's going on, Ben. And you know, if we in the United States are concerned, and we are, about what Iran might do, well, how about the countries that live right there in the close proximity? And so they are working together to put sanctions on trade and different things they can do to. On their economy, and they're starting to feel it. And at some point, that large group of young people that have access to today's technology and so on are going to say, you know, enough of this. This doesn't make any sense. And I think that is the way for us to go. But any use of force has to be an absolute last resort.
Okay. Let's talk about the partisan nature of Congress. Your two incumbents in this race. How would you deal with an increasingly partisan Congress if should you return? How would you better represent Iowa, given the partisan nature of Congress?
Well, Ben, I think, you know, in my service to the legislature and in Congress, I'm willing to compromise. I'm kind of like anybody else. I'd like to have the whole loaf of bread, but if I can't have it, what can we work out together? You can't have it far left. You can't have it far right. You kind of got to come towards the middle. And that's why I feel like I'm a moderate, and that's where we actually end up getting things done. And an example, you know, this Norquist pledge. Why on earth would anybody make a pledge to an individual after we've taken the oath to the Constitution? And I don't understand that. My opponent signed that, and I think that's uncalled for. And it just basically ties his hands to be able to sit down and do something like a version of Simpson Bowles. Simpson Bowles probably have a lot of adjustments to it as we went through it, but if it's both parties working together and give and take and doing what's best for the country, then that's what we ought to be doing, and I will continue to do that. All of us had a chance to vote for that version of Simpson-Bowles. 38 of us did. It was almost equally divided between Republicans and Democrats, and that's what's going to take to make us allow us to do what's right for the country and stop the partisan brinkmanship that just seems to be some people's idea that's how we do things. That's not the way to go.
Just less than a minute or so left. You've been in many campaigns. You're an eight-term congressman. And I wonder, in this campaign, what will you remember most about it?
Well, I did some research before we started to see what kind of campaigns. I never paid a whole lot of attention because I never had any campaign with my current opponent, and I realized what had happened historically, and I thought, whoa, wow. And then we got into the campaign, and over before last Christmas, over $1 million worth of negatives were run against us, and we realized that we had a really tough hill to climb, and I just couldn't lay down and take it. I was going to have to fight back. So we've done that, and but we have put up a positive ad. I think you hope you've seen it. It has to do with a little bit about my service and a lot, I hope, about the bill we passed, the Suicide Prevention Act, in the honor and name of one of my constituents who I became very close and dear to that family. And I think this is something that people ought to be aware of, that I really care, and I want to see our country move forward, and I want to see a future for our children, our grandchildren, and I think we can. We just got to get settled out and everybody pitch in and some compromise and go forward and quit the bickering.
Leonard Boswell, Congressman Leonard Boswell of Iowa's 3rd District, thank you very much for joining us this half hour.
Thank you, Ben. It's good to talk to you.
River to River is produced by Emily Woodbury. Production assistance today from Allison Sullivan. Technical support from Dennis Reese. John Pemble helped us out in Des Moines. The executive producer of Iowa Public Radio's talk shows is Catherine Perkins. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.